proposal changed from the one that Israel was initially approved, and this one that Hamas has agreed to?
So the fundamental obstacle in all of these ceasefire negotiations has been one central issue, and that is that Hamas has demanded that the hostage exchange be accompanied by an end to the war. And Israel has refused. It says it wants to get the hostages back and to do a prisoner exchange with Hamas and then to continue pummeling Gaza. Hamas and any other party in its place would be insane to accept such a deal. It is the only leverage they have, and they cannot afford to agree to a ceasefire, a so-called ceasefire, that has them relinquish the only asset that they have that Israel wants without a commitment that this is an end to the war. And so the fundamental issue is that Hamas says that the proposal that was given to it does entail an end to the war, a full, sustainable calm that's guaranteed by the United States and other mediators, and Israel says it rejects that. And we have seen the text of the proposal that Hamas has accepted. It is very close to what has been reported on all of the negotiations over the past week. And we haven't seen the text that Israel says slightly differs in wording.
Can you talk about what's going on the ground in Israel? I mean, we just reported that last night hostage families clashed with police in Tel Aviv. Two people were arrested. One sister of a hostage was hospitalized. Her mother said, end the war with Hamas. How significant is this movement of hostage families and all their allies? And is that putting pressure on Netanyahu? Do you think he is going to actually engage in this wholesale ground assault on Rafah?
The protests for a hostage exchange deal are a tremendous pressure on the government. And if they grow in size, they will make the current coalition and Netanyahu sweat even more. So they are very significant. You know, as we have seen, they are not sufficient yet to have gotten Israel to agree to a ceasefire proposal. And so far, Biden's limited threat has not been enough either.
So, Nathan, just to, you know, you have lived in Jerusalem and in Israel for many years, over a decade. We last spoke to you just days before the October 7th attack. If you could begin by talking about your response to Hamas's attack and then what's unfolded since, whether you were surprised by this, by either the scale of the Hamas attack, and then, of course, what Israel has unleashed on Gaza.
Yeah, the book tour that I was on began, you know, several days before October 7th, and I was actually in the U.S. and on Democracy Now! With the title character, Abed Salama. He and I had returned from an event on Friday night, and we got the news late that night, as it was early morning, Saturday morning, in Israel-Palestine, and we were both utterly shocked, and we realized that the entire atmosphere that would be, first of all, the entire atmosphere that his family is living in was about to change radically, and his entire community was locked down immediately, and that the whole region was going to change, not to mention the fact that there would be much more hostility toward the message of this book, and that it would be much more difficult for us to speak. And indeed, many of our events were canceled after October 7th.
And Nathan, could you situate, of course, you've just mentioned your book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. If you could talk about that book, what prompted it, and situate it in the context of what we've seen in the last several months?
Yeah. So, you know, the genesis of the book was really a frustration for me in working on Israel-Palestine for many years and watching as a heightened period of violence, like a war in Gaza, immediately brings Israel-Palestine into the news. It mobilizes students, and it gets the attention of the world. And leaders around the world invariably call for a restoration of calm. And what I wanted to write about in this book was that so-called calm, which is anything but calm for Palestinians. It's a system of domination that is extremely bureaucratic and elaborate and has lasted for over half a century. And it is not going anywhere. And so long as we are only seeing bloodshed, periodic bloodshed, and calling for a restoration of the so-called calm that existed before that bloodshed, we are doomed to see that bloodshed repeat. And my intention was to choose something seemingly commonplace, like a bus accident involving a group of Palestinian kindergartners, to describe this system of control and how ordinary people, Palestinians and Jews, living in this area, both navigate through the system that's controlling them and also implement and create this system. And so the idea was to bring our attention to this deeply, deeply unjust system that is fully supported by the United States and its Western allies.
And what was happening, Nathan, in the West Bank prior to October 7th, and now the number of people who've been killed since, killed and arrested, the Palestinians, since October 7th?
Prior to October 7th, we had already seen a spike in aggressive behavior from the army and armed settlers in the West Bank. The UN issued a small report at the end of September talking about unprecedented levels of forced displacement of Palestinian Bedouin. And it said that roughly 1,100 Palestinian Bedouin had been displaced in the last year and a half. In the period immediately after October 7th, while all the eyes of the world were on Gaza, an even greater number, more than 1,200 in just the weeks after October 7th, more than 1,200 Palestinian Bedouin were displaced in the West Bank. There has been a surge in violence. There have been hundreds of Palestinians who have been killed. Huge numbers who have been arrested, many of them held without trial or charge under so-called administrative detention, which can be held for up to 6 months and then renewed indefinitely. And in general, the restrictions on movement in the West Bank are the worst that they have ever been since the occupation began. It now takes me hours to get to locations that took me a half hour or 40 minutes in the past. All of the jobs, virtually all of them, in the settlements and in Israel, which so many Palestinian extended families depend on, these are the higher paying jobs for Palestinians in the West Bank, those have all but disappeared. And so Palestinians are strangled economically. They are strangled with in terms of their movement. I just went a few weeks ago to a dinner, an iftar dinner at Abed Salama's home. And his brother, who his entire family lives in Annatha, his brother lives in Ramallah. And he said he had not left Ramallah since October 7th because the restrictions on movement and also because of the unsafety, the settler attacks and all of the violence that is happening in the West Bank while the world's attention is focused on Gaza.
And so, Nathan, explain, why are all the discussions about a one-state or two-state solution as the possible resolution to this? Why do you think those conversations
I can't hear anything. I'm sorry.
We've lost audio. We're going to go to a music break, unless Nathan breaks in and says he can hear us. And then we'll come back, and then we're going to talk about the largest election in the world, India. We're talking to Nathan Thrall. He's speaking to us from Berlin, Germany, though he's usually based in Jerusalem. He's back. So, Nermeen, why don't you finish your question?
Nathan, I was asking you about why you think the discussions around a two-state or one-state solution are the wrong discussions to be happening.
You know, these conversations are premised on the notion that Israel eventually has to choose. It has to either give the millions of Palestinians living under its control without basic civil rights, it has to give them either citizenship with equality or statehood. And so many people in the diplomatic community would like to have, as they have been having for decades, debates about what a two-state outcome should look like, whether there should be two states or one state or confederation or what have you. And all of that is an enormous distraction from the reality on the ground, because the fact of the matter is Israel does not have to choose between two states and one state. It doesn't have to choose between giving Palestinians sovereignty or citizenship. It has a third option, which is to continue on the path that it's going down. The path that it's going down is a slow, de facto annexation of the West Bank, an absorption of the West Bank settlements in Area C, a takeover of Palestinian land, and a constriction of Palestinians into small, walled-off or fenced-off communities like the town of Annata, where my book takes place, or like Gaza. And so, rather than focusing on the reality, which is a movement in the opposite direction of either two states or equality in one state, but rather a deepening of this system of control that leading human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and the UN Human Rights Council and Al-Haq and B'Tselem have all described as a system of apartheid, rather than addressing that system, Israel would very much like for everybody to debate what would be the ideal outcome, what is the future utopia that we would all like, and let's only address this structural inequality, this systematic domination, once we've all agreed that we've landed on the right perfect outcome.
Nathan, before we go, we were remiss in not congratulating you on the Pulitzer Prize this week for your book. When you came here, it was
thank you very much.
It was 2 days before October 7th. Your book had just come out. You had event the Wazoo. So many of them were canceled. And you're in Berlin right now in Germany. Germany has been a remarkable scene where you have German police arresting Jewish protesters saying that they cannot criticize Israel. What has happened with your events from Germany to the United States as you raise questions about Israel's war on Gaza?
In Germany, I had an event that was to take place on Tuesday in Frankfurt that was canceled at the very last minute by the Union International Club in Frankfurt. And none of the people who canceled the event had read the book or knew a thing about it. And none of them had or provided any substantive reason for the cancellation. And the same thing was happening to me in the United States. And the reason in Germany is everybody is afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism. And what they're really being accused of is not anti-Semitism, but criticism of Israel that is described as anti-Semitism. And Israel has spent years, Israel and its allies have spent years in the United States and in Germany, putting forward a definition of anti-Semitism that includes criticism of Israel, entirely legitimate criticism of Israel, and trying to get around our basic democratic commitment to free speech by describing a speech that is entirely legitimate as anti-Semitic. And so that's what's happened here. And who, of course, is the close ally of Israel, the most pro-Israel force here in Germany? It's the far right party. As we see elsewhere, ethno-nationalists love Israel as a model for the kind of place they want to become, an ethno-national state that will dominate over people who are not like them.
Nathan Thrall, again, congratulations on winning the Pulitzer Prize today for your book. We're speaking to you in Berlin, Germany. You're headed back to Jerusalem, where you usually live. Awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his most recent book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Anatomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy. To see our hour with them on Democracy Now!, Abed Salama and Nathan Thrall, right after the book was published, you can go to democracynow.org. Coming up, the largest election in the world is underway now in India. Close to 1 billion people are eligible to vote. We'll speak with the award-winning Indian journalist Siddharth Deb. Stay with us. Sunny Singh here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Millions of voters in India are casting their ballots in the third phase of the country's mammoth general election. Voting began on April 19th in a seven-phase election, which is taking place over a month and a half. Nearly 1 billion people are eligible to vote. Ballots are set to be counted on June 4th. Among those who cast their ballots on earlier this week was incumbent Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is seeking a rare third straight term in office. The election pits Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP party against an alliance of more than two dozen opposition parties led by the Indian National Congress. Modi's opponents have accused him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as, quote, infiltrators, prompting the Congress party to file a formal complaint against Modi with election authorities. Voter turnout in this year's election has declined compared to the 2019 vote.
For more, we're joined in our New York studio by Siddharth Deb, award-winning Indian author and journalist born in Northeast India. His most recent novel is The Light at the End of the World. His new nonfiction book is Twilight Prisoners, The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. He's a professor of literary studies at the New School in New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Congratulations on the release of the book. Let's start off by talking about this mammoth election, the biggest in the world, even if it may not be as much turnout even as 2019. Can you talk about what's at stake and whether Narendra Modi is expected to win by as huge a margin as was predicted?
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be back here. Thank you. Nice to see you again, Narmeen. I think, you know, it's hard to make these predictions, but it seems very likely that it is not, as we can see from the declining voter participation. We can also see from Narendra Modi sort of anting up the hate speech that there is a kind of concern within the Hindu right, within the BJP, that it's not going to be as sweeping as 2019 or 2014. And that's partly because, you know, the Hindu right have delivered on all the things, all the big promises they had made, which are basically based on hatred and demonization of Muslims. There's really no agenda for actual development. There is really no agenda for, you know, public health, people's security. Things are tremendously precarious on a day-to-day level at India for people. And we can see that beginning to trickle in even among the supporters. Is it going to be enough to prevent him from the Hindu right from winning the elections this time? Probably not. But yes, I do think there is a kind of, you know, they sense that things are changing. And you can see people. That's why he's being brought up the whole Ghuspetia. That's the word for infiltrators that they have used for a long time. That he's trying to, you know, it's the same rhetoric, but they're just trying to increase the amount of it, basically.
So if you could explain, Siddharth, I mean, your book is called, Twilight Prisoners, and the subtitle is The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. So if you could explain what exactly you think has happened under successive Modi regimes, just before, as India was getting ready for the elections, the World Inequality Lab came out with a study titled The Rise of the Billionaire Raj, which shows that income inequality in India is worse than it was under British colonial rule. So, as against what most people think about India shining and India rising, what's happening in India?
Well, Nermeen, you're absolutely right. It is worse than under colonial rule, and that is saying something, because when the British left the Indian subcontinent, I believe the average life expectancy was 26. It was that kind of inequality. And Modi's regime has basically empowered a small set of oligarchs, basically. But again, in terms of everyday life for people, there's a tremendous amount of precariousness. There's a tremendous amount of food insecurity. There's a tremendous, we saw in the handling, for instance, of the pandemic, which the Hindu right is trying to spin. But we saw how abysmal Modi's and the Hindu right's handling of the pandemic was. And it was not just the poor that suffered. It was the middle class, even the well-to-do in India, were scrambling for oxygen tanks and hospital beds in some of the most expensive hospitals in India. So that's the kind of chaos that Modi has, you know, presided over. There's been a tremendous upward transfer of wealth. And again, it is beginning to show through. The cracks are beginning to become visible, even to his core supporters, I think.
And also at the level, Siddharth, that's obviously social indicators, mm-hmm. which are very important, mm-hmm. but also at the political level, at the level of altering India's orientation, in particular towards Muslims, but to minorities in general. If you could speak specifically about this Partition Horrors Remembrance Day, who that's directed towards, who experienced these horrors. And then second, you've actually been to Ayodhya, where the Babri Masjid was destroyed in 1992, and where earlier this year, the Ram Mandir was built. If you could speak about the significance of both these things.
So, you know, just to connect, in some sense, you know, the Hindu right in India are trying to create an ethno-nationalist state. And that's one of the reasons, and it's really ironic, one of the great ironies of history, that the Hindu right is modeled explicitly after the Italian fascists and the Nazis. And now they are great allies of Israel. And for the same reasons, they admire this idea of a strong, muscular, militant majority that are the only people who have the right to this nation. And the minorities must be dominated, must be brutalized or expelled. And that Hindu rights project has been, and the main platforms of it, for symbolic reasons, to rouse up this sort of, you know, national, to create this, concoct this Hindu identity. One of the platforms has been to, you know, has been to build the temple. And this goes back to the BJP's rise as a political party and the demolition of the Babri Masjid in 1992. And so, yes, I was there in 2021 to report on the construction of the temple and built. You know, there is no evidence the Hindu temple actually had existed underneath this mosque. There's no archaeological evidence. But the thing is that, you know, Modi and the Hindu right seize on these symbolic things as opposed to substantive things, because the substantive things are food security, public health, climate collapse. You just had the report on Bangladesh. My mother's in Calcutta. The heat in Bengal is incredible. So there's no discussion of these substantial questions. There is just the enriching of the oligarchs. and for this quote-unquote, this notional Hindu majority, they're these symbolic issues. We will give you a Ram temple to avenge the humiliation of the Muslims because the Muslims are outsiders, again, quote-unquote, in this Hindu right mind. But, you know, when I went to Ayodhya, yes, there is this giant million-dollar temple complex being built, gargantuan, on a very sleepy little pilgrimage town, actually. But, you know, if you walk around, the roads are waterlogged, it's muddy, there is people are tremendously impoverished, there is an incredible gender disparity. You barely see any women on the streets. It is such a masculine, violent, patriarchal kind of, you know, project that they're pushing forward. And that's what we are seeing again and again in India.
India is currently the largest importer of Israeli weapons in the world.
Yes.
Narendra Modi banned from the United States for years after the Gujarat massacre.
Yes.
He was the equivalent of the governor of Gujarat at the time. The significance of this going right through to the election now, you have his opponents accusing him of using hate speech after he described Muslims in India as, quote, infiltrators, the opposition Congress Party filing a formal complaint against him with election authorities. The significance of all this happening now, would you say he is getting more extreme? And what about the U.S. relationship with India?
Oh, you know, Amy, he's not getting more extreme. He has always, and it's not just Modi, the Hindu right, they've always been extreme. They have been extreme. So to go back to Narmeen's question on the Partition Horrors Museum, they were extreme even in 1947. When the partition took place. And I take great offense. My father was a refugee from the partition of what became Bangladesh. Modi is just weaponizing this completely one-sided. The Hindu right participated gleefully in the massacres and the rapes that accompanied the partition. Everybody suffered. Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Dalits. People suffered on a very large scale. And they are simply weaponizing it into this sort of this, again, this notion that the Muslims are the villains and the Hindus are these perfect victims. And that's not true. But, you know, we see this, in terms of the U.S. relations, every U.S. administration we have seen since that initial rejection of a visa for Modi when he was the chief minister of Gujarat under 2002, once Modi won the elections in 2014, once he became the prime minister, the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the Biden administration, every single administration has embraced Modi, has embraced the Hindu right, and looked the other way in spite of these egregious violations of human rights and utter violence. So in that sense, he hasn't become more extreme. I was in Assam reporting for the New York Times Magazine. I have seen Modi's Home Minister Amit Shah come down in a helicopter to a rally and talk about Muslims as ghuspaitias, or the word infiltrators. You know, it's on record. They have been doing it again and again. People are compared to ants and crows. That's what they are. This is genocidal language. And the U.S. has stood aside. And yes, India is the largest arms importer in the world, and not just a purchase of arms from Israel, but also from the United States and from Britain and from France, all the great Western democratic powers.
And so that, before we end, if you could just say how you understand Modi's change in policy, India's change in policy vis-a-vis Israel, because for decades after partition,
yes,
India was totally pro-Palestinian.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's partly also, you know, this has not been very hard for me to think about. I mean, I was for Palestinian rights. That was part of my political formation growing up as a teenager in India, because, you know, India's own experience of colonialism, which was horrific, it just made it very, very clear that we would be for Palestine, but without ever marginalizing the suffering of Jews, not just in the Shoah, but centuries of European anti-Semitism. These were part and parcel of our anti-colonial identity. It's for the same reason that we were against apartheid South Africa. It was for the same reason that we were for civil rights in the United States. And now, it is basically a coming together of these ethno-nationalist muscular states that admire each other. And that's what the Hindu right is, and that's what the Israel is, and the United States supports them both.
And we just have 10 seconds, but you're a professor at the New School. The New School has just set up a faculty encampment, maybe the first in the country, to defend the students, the significance of this.
I absolutely find it amazing. I think the students have been incredibly inspiring. We would not have found out about the New School's complicity in Israeli weapons manufacturing in the war, and the students have actually made that clear. And so, yes, it's our duty as faculty in a place that touts social justice to stand with them.
Siddharth Deb, award-winning Indian journalist, born in Northeast India. His latest book is called Twilight Prisoners.